Here are two new ways that you can promote Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. business card and the Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer. Simply go to the support page at issuesetc.org, click Issues Etc. business cards, print the page on suitable stock paper, and cut along the lines. We also have an 8.5 by 11 inch flyer for the bulletin board at your church. Issuesetc.org, go to the support page, click Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer, and print.
No matter what we choose to believe, there's no God who condones taking the life of an innocent human being.
Where I think we are in the culture, but also with religious institutions, is that people have stopped hating us, that is to say LGBT people, but they're not yet ready to celebrate us. That's the next big work to do.
Maybe it's something as simple as you whistle while you work.
Just whistle while you work.
Mega churches are a house of cards. Mega churches really are the primary example of what's wrong with evangelicalism, why it's so thin, so insubstantial, so unsatisfying.
Southern Illinois truck drivers who love Issues, etc.
I think it's safe to say that he is one of the most overtly religious presidents of the modern era. He probably stands right alongside President Jimmy Carter. President George W. Bush and President Jimmy Carter, two very overtly religious presidents. Now, you may disagree with his policies on the economy or foreign policy or the wars that he prosecuted, but what about his track record on embryonic stem cell research, on life, on marriage? What role did his faith play during his presidency? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Tuesday afternoon, the 20th of September. Joining us in this hour to discuss the faith of President George W. Bush and his record on social issues is Tim Gagelein, Vice President of External Relations for Focus on the Family. He formerly served as Deputy Director of the White House Office of Public Liaison, and he's author of the new book, The Man in the Middle, an inside account of faith and politics in the George W. Bush era. Tim, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Tim, how would you describe the faith of George W. Bush and your contact with him over those years in the White House?
Well, I say in The Man in the Middle, and I'm very clear about this from the beginning of the book, Todd, that George W. Bush is an evangelical, but with a Catholic sensibility. He was a president who intuitively understood the realms that St. Augustine makes so clear in The City of God and The City of Man. He really intuitively understood this is Athens and that's Jerusalem, which is a fancy way of saying that he understood that this is the realm of civil government, this is the realm of public policy, the area where our politics take place. But as a Christian and as a well-regarded Christian, George W. Bush also understood that his faith was not going to be underneath a bushel basket. That there was a long trajectory and great history in the United States of presidents of both parties, both ideologies, left and right, who were not shy about saying that they were praying men, that they relied on providence or the Almighty, as George W. Bush referred to God. And George W. Bush was in that great line of presidents.
How would you respond to some who criticize George W. Bush for making decisions based on faith rather than on facts and sound reason?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. There were cartoons and stereotypes which were routinely painted of George W. Bush because he let it be known that he was a Christian. And I think that this began very early. I was at the debate, and I write about in The Man in the Middle, I don't remember, it's one of the early chapters, I write about being at the Iowa debate. When several of the 2000 Republican presidential candidates, the year 2000 presidential candidates, were asked, Todd, who their favorite philosopher was. And I think one of them said John Locke, and there were various answers. George W. Bush said Jesus Christ because he changed my life. And I think that this was very surprising and maybe even stunning to a number of people, Christians and non-Christians alike, that George W. Bush would be so public in his faith. And when I was researching the man in the middle, I looked at all the contemporary presidents. I looked at what they said about their faith, about providence, about the providential hand and role of faith in the United States. I looked at presidents of both parties and both ideologies, and I was really surprised by what I found. Two things: George W. Bush was fully between the 30-yard line. He was in a not just historically. I mean, only 44 men have been president. He was clearly in the historic line of what was said in public and about faith and what was not. But even in the contemporary presidency, there were some rather bold strokes. People forget that one of the greatest liberals and greatest Democrats of American history, the only man to be elected four times to the White House, Franklin Roosevelt, when he announced the invasion of Europe, he chose to do so not by just a standard speech. He actually delivered his speech in the form of a major prayer. And FDR was a serious churchman. Now, if George W. Bush or any other really contemporary president had chosen to do that, that would have been considered bad manners and fodder for criticism. But George W. Bush was not shy about speaking about his faith, but nor did he wear it on his sleeve. And I think that this is the proper ballast and the one that I think was the right ballast. And I think, as I say in the subtext to the book, that faith and public life, faith and politics, they do go together in America. Because I think with Michael Novak that you can't understand America unless you understand us as a profoundly religious republic from the earliest dates of our founding.
Why do you think it is that President Obama talks a lot about his faith? He's between those 30-yard lines as well, I think. And yet he is seldom criticized for allowing his faith to over-influence his policies.
You know, it's interesting. I have developed a number of friendships with President Obama's staff. And I am a conservative and a Republican. And my friends are liberals and Democrats. So I would say that on the overwhelming majority of policies and policy decisions, you know, we just disagree, but we are friends in Christ, and a number of my friends in the Obama administration are outspoken about their faith. You know, in my opinion, it's a bit of a dangerous ground to publicly call out a president or a senator or a congressman if we are not certain about what they themselves say is true about their own faith. And so I think in this regard, as with President Bush, I think it was unfair to purposely create a sort of poisonous, toxic view of a man's faith. I think it's much better, and I think the one that is fully in the American tradition, to be more serious, you know, in a normative sense, not an eternal sense, but in a normative sense, to have viewpoints about the evocation of how faith is discussed in public, and above all, what those policy decisions are that may or may not elicit sort of a glimpse into that person's faith. George W. Bush spoke in the pulpit of the Washington National Cathedral during that 9/14 service of the Day of Prayer and Remembrance. Every single year that he was president, he chose to commemorate the National Day of Prayer with a high-profile event in the East Room. He was the only U.S. president to speak each year to the National Right to Life March on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade. I think categorically he was the most pro-life, pro-family, pro-religious liberty, pro sort of religious conscience president of the modern era. In fact, I think without peer in that regard. Now, on one hand, I would say, you know, those are the public policies or those were the decisions. But as I say in The Man in the Middle, Todd, I think it would be irresponsible and ahistorical to say that in some way those decisions or those speeches were somehow decoupled from or divorced from President Bush's Christianity. I think that is not the case. I think they are an emanation, at least at one remove, of a responsible use of this relationship between faith and public life.
Now, you mentioned before that you want to portray him as an evangelical with a Catholic sensibility. He was officially a member of one of the more liberal church bodies in America, the United Methodist Church. Do you have any idea why he would belong to a church body that in some of its positions, opposed many of his views on those important social issues you just talked about.
You know, I'm really glad that you asked me that, because I've come to learn, and I did this in my role with President Bush, that there were many meetings that I would attend, some of them very large meetings and some of them relatively small, with Christians who were members of what might broadly be called mainline Christianity, which in the president's own family history was very prominent. His father is a cradle member of the Episcopal Church. His mother is a member of the Presbyterian Church. Growing up, George W. Bush, you know, was variously in both of those denominational traditions. But what I came to learn in working for the president, not just and not only among American Methodists, but American Episcopalians and many others, is that there was not unanimity of view within those denominations on what you and I would say are sort of cutting-edge social questions. I have met many, many Methodists who are and were pro-life, for instance, and I've met many Methodists who were not, and this is true of many of the mainline denominations. In other words, I think that the national policy bodies of those denominations often are you know, more definitive about the public policy positions that that church body may or may not take. But I've come to see that there is a kind of federalist small F spirit within American mainline Christianity, maybe even more so than ever in the history of those denominations. And I've come to see that it often depends on the local church or the local parish as to how you know, the majority of members of those churches or parishes view particular issues. And the good news is that I also met and I would say this is the overwhelming majority of mainline Christians, where by and large, and there were exceptions, but by and large in those local parishes and churches, there was not a fulsome discussion, you know, of political issues of the day, and that even a number of otherwise conservative Christians were more comfortable worshiping in a place where there was not really a very furtive or spirited discussion of issues that were, you know, the ones that we would say are the more cutting-edge social questions. But George W. Bush, I feel very confident, as a Methodist in good standing, was the most pro-life president in American history. And I think that history will bear out that in this great civil rights issue of our time, George W. Bush was literally steadfast for the innocent preborn.
We're talking about the faith of President George W. Bush, his track record on social issues with Tim Gagline, former deputy director of the White House Office of Public Liaison, author of the book The Man in the Middle. When we come back, we'll turn to the subject of embryo-destructive research.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Wouldn't it be great if more of your fellow parishioners listened to Issues, Etc.? Well, here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues, Etc. at your church. Go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. The bulletin blurb is updated weekly. Issuesetc.org. Stay connected. Issuesetc.org.
How does error find its way into the church? I've written an article in the latest edition of the online Issues Etc. journal titled From Exception to Rule, How Error Replaces Truth in the Church, and we'll send it to you for free. Just send your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Jordan Cooper details his journey from Calvinism to Lutheranism. The latest Issues Etc. journal, journal@issuesetc.org. Welcome back. It's Tuesday afternoon, September the 20th. Tim Gagline is our guest. We're talking about the faith of President George W. Bush, his track record on social issues, turning to the subject of embryonic stem cell research. Tim, this was kind of his coming out on the pro-life issue. It was August in 2001, very early in his first term. How do you think history will evaluate that August 2001 ban that limited the lines of embryonic stem cells that could be used by researchers with federal funding?
Well, I write a whole chapter on the stem cell decision in The Man in the Middle. And I'm really thrilled, actually, that you asked me this question, because I believe that this is one of the cornerstone foundations of the Bush administration. And in fact, I think that as far as public policies go, most historians will spend an inordinate amount of time not only on the president's final decision on stem cells as it relates to biotechnology, as it relates to cloning, obviously as one of the central 21st century pro-life issues. But I think that this actually goes to the heart of the relationship between faith and political life. I was very much a part, not of the policy decision. I was not a confidant to the president. I was not the person who the president was calling. I was not even a senior-most aide. I mean, I was one of Karl Rove's deputies, and I make that very clear in The Man in the Middle. That to say, my role was to be a person who was being a reliable conduit for the president's decision-making. I was a reliable conduit after the president made the decision, and also to make sure that while the president was deciding, that I was faithfully feeding into the White House bloodstream a wide variety of views by a wide variety of the faith-based groups broadly defined. And the president took his time. He was deliberate in this regard. And the net result was not only a famously pro-life decision, but also it was a decision that was one that will have large historic ramifications, because the avenues that came off the stem cell decision relate directly to the next generation of biotechnological and questions of cloning. And what I think is important, Todd, to the heart of your question, is that in the history of the American presidency, without peer, this was the most pro-life decision ever announced in prime time by a president. The president was at his Prairie Chapel Ranch, and he decided in prime time to deliver what is, by all standards, a truly extraordinary speech. It gets to the heart of George W. Bush's view that every person who was ever born mattered, that every person has dignity and sanctity. And I believe very firmly that this arises, as I say in the book, this arises from his faith.
There were and still are critics of pro-life conviction who say that even in this decision, as pro-life as it was, the president was compromising. How do you respond?
Yeah, I'm actually really glad that you asked me that, and I addressed this in the book head on. It is very clear, at least early on, and I wonder, in retrospect, whether people who were early critics of the Bush policy would actually still contend that they were right in that regard. And I'm not calling out anybody. I mean, I think it's fully possible that people who disagreed with the president, would still disagree. But I am now a vice president at Focus on the Family, and I quote in The Man in the Middle, Focus's bioethics analyst, my colleague Carrie Gordon Earle. And I quote her specifically because she said something that I think, got to the heart of the question that you raised, because she said that what the president is talking about is using cell lines with embryos that have already been killed. And what she said so well, she said, we grieve the loss of those embryos, but the truth is they are gone, and we can't change that. And then she said, he, meaning the president, is not talking about destroying any more with the involvement of federal dollars. I think that that's exactly right. There were going to be a limited number of stem cell lines, ones that were obtained in a way that was really heartbreaking with regard to the destruction of the former embryos. But going forward, would the federal government actually pay for their destruction for research purposes? And that is exactly and precisely where George W. Bush chose to draw the line. And I say in a chapter in the book called Stem Cells Before the Storm that we had plenty of criticism from otherwise pro-life groups, But we also had plenty of support from pro-life groups. And so I think it's fair to say that the pro-life community was not of one piece on this issue. And I think it's fair also to say overwhelmingly favored the Bush policy. And I think now in light of President Obama negating the Bush decision, going in a completely different direction, and actually taking a position, the Obama administration, in opposition to Congress's original intent in this, and I write about this at length in The Man in the Middle, I think it goes to show just what an incredibly pro-life policy the Bush policy was in those years.
We have over the years interviewed several members, several times, of the President's Council on Bioethics, Leon Kass, Gilbert Mailander, and Bill Hurl. But tell us about the chartering of that Presidential Council on Bioethics.
You know, I am so glad to get a question like this because Gil and Leon are great friends, and we at one point worked very closely together, and I feel confident we would say the same. The president knew that he was coming out with a decision that would not be accepted by all the members, broadly speaking, of the pro-life community, and that he was making a decision that certainly would not be fully embraced by the whole of the scientific community, you know, broadly defined. Although, as I say in The Man in the Middle, Todd, there were actually a number of very prominent scientists who did support and would continue to support the president's decision. But President Bush wanted to make sure that the decision having been made, that in chartering a permanent standing presidential commission, that it would allow for other viewpoints. And that was not the president negating his own policy decision. Clearly, Leon Kass and Gil Mailander, very important men, learned men in this area, would certainly uphold the Bush policy, and that was the case during the Bush years. But President Bush also understood that it's a large country, and he wanted other responsible, though differing, viewpoints on the council. And so we were very careful in that regard, and I think history will bear out that much, not all of, but much of the work on that council, that commission, turned out to be very important. And, of course, when President Obama came to office, changing that policy away from a pro-life policy, clearly the direction and the narrative and the intent of that commission was fully overturned.
What was President Bush able to accomplish during his 8 years in office on the abortion issue?
Let me just say this. We have not yet had fully the value or utility of knowing what it means to put a Chief Justice of the United States into place, John Roberts, and another Associate Justice, Samuel Alito, nor 35% of all sitting federal judges, both appellate and district. And I write in The Man in the Middle intimately and broadly about my involvement in both of those Supreme Court nomination battles and in part about the federal appellate and district battles. But I believe at the end of the day that the largest standing domestic achievement that a president leaves, potentially, is the way that he shapes or reshapes the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary, because ultimately that's where those decisions on the pro-life question regarding Roe versus Wade, Doe v. Bolton, the Major Casey decision, this is where those decisions are made. And I feel very confident that President Bush was careful in choosing. He did not have a litmus test for who he chose, but he had a set of immutable principles, first principles, constitutional originalism, that justices and judges were not supposed to be legislators in black robes. In fact, during the first campaign, the president was asked at length, "What kind of a person will you choose?" And he repeatedly said, someone in the vein of Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas. So I believe that when it comes to potential future federal and Supreme Court cases, that George W. Bush's decisions will be vindicated in that regard. But with regard to the pro-life question otherwise, he signed the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. He signed the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. His predecessor, Bill Clinton, had vetoed not once but twice the ban on partial birth abortion. And George W. Bush vetoed, essentially, he signed the ban on partial birth abortion and essentially vetoed the Bill Clinton decision. And, Todd, he continued to vigorously fight those in the Department of Justice until the last hour of the last day of the Bush administration. And I think the stem cell decision we talked about was absolutely huge. And other major decisions in the United Nations, in the State Department, in the international treaties, anything and everything that was not consonant with his pro-life position was changed, and I think that he will be vindicated in that regard.
Tim Gagline is our guest, Vice President of External Relations for Focus on the Family, formerly served as Deputy Director of the White House Office of Public Liaison, and he's author of the new book, The Man in the Middle, An Inside Account of Faith and Politics in the George W. Bush Era. Now, there's no doubt that pro-lifers consider George W. Bush to be on their side. Some of them doubted his ability to adequately articulate the case from the bully pulpit. We'll see what Tim thinks about that right after this. If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The healing power of adult stem cells.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
There is yet another exciting story from the world of adult stem cells. Discovery News recently reported on one man who was dying of tracheal cancer. Doctors took a synthetic windpipe and covered it with the man's own cells. His body accepted the transplant and it saved his life. Adult stem cell transplant stories like this are increasingly common. In this case, doctors say it means patients may not have to wait for windpipe transplants. The power of one's own cells, which can be harvested harmlessly, is leading to medical breakthroughs all over the world.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Tim Gagline is our guest. We're talking about the faith of President George W. Bush and his track record on social issues in just a minute, embryonic stem cell research, and his ability to articulate the case for life from the bully pulpit that the president possesses while he's in office. We get monthly updates from Thrivent Financial for Lutherans on how our listeners are supporting us through Thrivent Choice and the other ways that Thrivent provides for our listeners to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. Now, if you're a member of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans and you don't support Issues Etc., here's how you can. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. Right there in the middle of the page, you'll see the logo for Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Click on that. You'll find several ways that you can designate your Thrivent dollars to help support Issues Etc. Now, you need to remember that Issues Etc. is produced by a Lutheran public radio, so when you designate those dollars at the Thrivent webpage, do it for Lutheran Public Radio. Thanks to all who already do. And thanks in advance for supporting us through Thrivent Choice, Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Tim, on the pro-life front, I think many pro-lifers were very confident that President Bush was on their side, but they feared that he couldn't adequately articulate the case from the bully pulpit. What's your response?
You know, I'm glad that you asked that question, Todd, because when I was writing The Man in the Middle, I went back to all of the major speeches that the president delivered, beginning with the primetime speech on stem cell research, and then to the speeches that he delivered each and every year at the National Right to Life March, and then also, and this is a little known or little remembered speech, but the speech that he delivered on the day when he formally decided to ban a partial birth abortion. So I read through several speeches in preparation for The Man in the Middle, and I was really pleasantly surprised at how outstanding those speeches are, none more so than the stem cell speech. But President Bush was a very articulate and consistent defender of the pro-life position. Of course, the most important thing is that he got the policies right. And I think that for those who have criticized him in the past, I feel very confident he will be remembered as the most pro-life president, really, in the contemporary presidency since Roe versus Wade. But when I go back and look specifically at those three or four very important speeches, they were fluid, they were eloquent, they were bold, and yet, in the way that they needed to be, they were winsome. And so I feel very confident that he more than rose to the occasion, but none more so than the primetime speech on stem cell research.
What was President George W. Bush's track record in the end on traditional marriage?
You know, it's interesting. George W. Bush was clear in the early part of his career as president. And I might say even before that as governor of Texas, that in the long American tradition, he believed that the states primarily had the first function and the first role on marriage. And he articulated that very consistently beginning in the early 2000 presidential campaign. What he saw happening, and I write about this in The Man in the Middle, what he saw happening was an encroachment that by legislative, judicial, and in some ways executive branch fiat, laws that had historically protected marriage in the states and had given large leeway to marriage in the states was being usurped by the federal government. And in the Don't Ask, Don't Tell era, for instance, or in the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, in both of those instances, President Bush was very much in line with then-President Clinton, who, although he disagreed with them, eventually came and signed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but above all, the Defense of Marriage Act. It was very clear, however, by the very early 2000s, that because of largely judicial fiat, never allowing the people to have a decision or a choice in these matters, the state's decision was being squelched, and the overlords, and that's a strong word, but the overlords within the states were making those decisions in light of the people's opinion. The people were never deciding, never being asked their opinion. And George W. Bush came to the conclusion that in that rare instance, we should amend the federal Constitution to have a Defense of Marriage Act. And he came to this deliberately, but he came to this decision because he came to believe that, unfortunately, the power that historically been reserved for the states was being usurped. And in this instance, he felt, in a rare decision, that the Constitution should be amended to protect marriage. And I think in light of all of the same-sex marriage battles that we have had since then, that the president's decision was the right one. Despite that, only six American states and the District of Columbia have same-sex marriage today. In each and every instance, the people have not decided. It has been decided either by governors or by state legislatures or by judicial fiat. in all the states, more than 30 of them, where the people have been asked their opinion, traditional marriage has been preserved. And yet we're on a trajectory where we will continue to watch the Defense of Marriage Act be taken apart limb by limb, and we have never needed a federal marriage amendment more than now.
Did you ever talk to President Bush about the differences that he had with the First Lady and with his mother on some of these social issues?
You know, I never discussed with the president the policy decisions that he had with the First Lady or with his mother or within his family. But I heard President Bush, you know, acknowledge, and I heard him do this in the post-presidency, that, in fact, there were members of his family who disagreed on the question of life, on the question of marriage. And yet, despite those differences within families, President Bush remained steadfast. He remained steadfast in supporting traditional marriage. And in fact, he referred to marriage as a sacred institution, which came directly from his faith. In one of the passages that I quote in The Man in the Middle, President Bush said that the nuclear family was the unseen pillar of civilization. I thought that that was a wonderful, beautiful phrase. On the question of the pro-life issue, there is no doubt that there were differences, you know, between and among President Bush and members of his family. And yet, in each and every turn, in the areas where it was most crucial, he stood steadfast in defense of innocent preborn life. And I think for those reasons, historians will look back at the Bush administration and conclude that on the most cutting-edge social questions of his time, the issue of pro-life and the issue of the nuclear family and opposite traditional marriage, that, in fact, George W. Bush was right.
What can you tell us about his relationship with one of our frequent guests over the years, the late Father Richard John Newhouse?
I'm so glad you asked that. I mentioned very early, Todd, in this interview, that George W. Bush was a kind of evangelical Christian who had a very Catholic sensibility. And in The Man in the Middle, I write in more than one chapter of the remarkable influence that the Catholic tradition of subsidiarity has, which is to say that the way that we are to help orphans and widows and prisoners and the hopelessly drug and alcohol addicted, the downtrodden among us. President Bush did, in fact, meet with the late Father Richard John Newhouse in the White House. They met. They knew of one another, and President Bush was very, very conversant on Father Newhouse's great writings and also on Father Newhouse's really singular role in two ways. Father Newhouse's view that without a fulsome Judeo-Christian tradition, ours would be a naked public square. That was something that George W. Bush agreed with very strongly and, in fact, is the subtext to my book. And secondly, he gave Father Newhouse a lot of credit for the wonderful cooperation among evangelical Christians and the Roman Catholic Church. It's easy to forget that until the early 1990s, evangelicals and Catholics, who had so much in common on social policy, even where they may have disagreed theologically, were not always working in tandem. And yet Chuck Colson and Father Newhouse famously came to work together and to find ways that, in fact, in the public square, where evangelical and Catholic Christians could work together. And Father Newhouse really deserves the lion's share of the credit for that. You know, he was a marcher in the great civil rights marches of the 1960s with the late Dr. Martin Luther King. And Father Newhouse had a passionate pro-life view, which George W. Bush shared. And I write in The Man in the Middle that, in fact, President Bush developed a friendship and a very strong working relationship with the late Pope John Paul II, of whom the late Richard Newhouse held in the highest regard. So there was a great friendship and a great working relationship, both with Pope John Paul II and especially with Father Newhouse. And we still to this day really mourn his passing because his writing was so crystalline, it was so salient, so eloquent, and so irrelevant to this view of faith and political life.
Tim Gagelein is author of the new book, The Man in the Middle, an inside account of faith and politics in the George W. Bush era. We'll be back 10 more minutes with him after this.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Here's a resource for your high school or college-age child or grandchild as they begin a new school year. It's Concordia's Complete Bible Handbook for Students. You'll find an introduction with answers to questions like, is the Bible reliable and trustworthy? Who wrote the Bible? And more. You can order Concordia's Complete Bible Handbook for Students by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Concordia's Complete Bible Handbook for Students.
Here are two new ways that you can promote Issues, Etc. The Issues, Etc. business card and the Issues, Etc. bulletin board flyer. Simply go to the support page at issuesetc.org, click Issues, Etc. business cards, print the page on suitable stock paper, and cut along the lines. We also have an 8.5 by 11-inch flyer for the bulletin board at your church. Issuesetc.org, go to the support page, click Issues, Etc. bulletin board flyer, and print.
Welcome back. We're talking about the faith of President George W. Bush and his track record on social issues. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Tim Gagelein is our guest. Tim, you talked before about the relationship he had with Pope John Paul II, Father Richard John Newhouse. What about any relationship, and this would have been late in his second term, that he may have had with now Pope Benedict XVI?
Well, yes. First, this is important, I think, to say that George W. Bush met with Pope John Paul II not one, not two, but three times. And I write about this rather fulsomely in The Man in the Middle. And I was with President Bush, in fact, in Rome for the funeral of Pope John Paul II, which was a rather extraordinary world gathering. And I write in the book of being in near the Trevi Fountain in Rome, having lunch with Michael Novak, a very prominent a Catholic historian and important Christian philosopher. And I remember turning to Michael and saying, you know, who do you think will be the Pope's successor? And in a very tender way, Michael said, Ratzinger. I think we'll do very well with him, referring to the late Cardinal Ratzinger, who became Pope Benedict. And George W. Bush met Cardinal Ratzinger during Pope John Paul II's funeral, and later invited Benedict to come to the White House. And in fact, before I left the White House, one of the last things that I worked on was the very large South Lawn ceremony at the White House, welcoming Pope Benedict and to the White House. And I'm very glad that you asked this, because without parallel, and going back to your question about Richard John Newhouse, in the history of the United States, and this is a big statement, in the history of the United States, I cannot think of another gathering at the White House where a major world leader and a sitting president of the United States gave a more dramatic and bookended set of speeches on the relation of faith and public life, social and moral decay as a consequence of the Judaic Christian tradition being secularized. And when Benedict and when President Bush spoke that day on the South Lawn, I quote extensively from their speeches in the book, but having been there and listening to them, I was really dazzled by the narrative that each man had about the central role and different role of the church and state in the proper and healthy functioning of a great country like ours.
Post 9/11, President Bush often stated that Islam is peace or Islam is a religion of peace. Was there anyone in his circle that educated or informed President Bush about the history and teachings of Islam?
You know, after 9/11, I think that this is a broad statement, but I think it's accurate. Just after 9/11, all Americans were beginning to learn about the nature of Islam. Islam had grown up and was having a large. When I say grown up, I mean it had become a central part of many European countries. And little by little, Islam was taking hold in the United States. But when 9/11 happened, it focused everybody's attention, including President Bush, like a laser beam on what was the nature of Islam. And President Bush was always careful to distinguish Islam from radical jihadism. And President Bush took a fair amount of criticism for making that particular statement about Islam. And I write in The Man in the Middle that I believe that radical jihadism is, in fact, one of the great threats to our liberty and way of life. And I think that even now, as we speak, on a multiplicity of fronts, in the church, in the synagogue, in the federal government, in the military, in the media, in the think tanks, in the public policy groups, all of us are learning more about the nature of Islam, and we are learning about the way that it will become compatible with a constitutional republic. These are flashpoints in Europe, and we've heard just in the last year several European leaders actually talk about the potential dangers of multiculturalism. And I think that this is in part an extension of some of the comments that President Bush made. But yes, as with everybody, the president was learning about the nature of Islam, and he was learning to make distinctions. And I think even now we are really on a very large trajectory about what this means for the United States in this new century and the future of our security and liberty.
I think Lutherans, Roman Catholics, Eastern Orthodox, many confessional Calvinists reject a popular teaching among many evangelicals that the state of Israel enjoys most favored nation status with God. Did President George W. Bush believe this popular evangelical teaching? And if he did, do you think that belief influenced some of his foreign policy decisions?
You know, I never had a discussion with the president about this, and I never had a discussion about this with any of my, senior, more colleagues in the White House. And so I think I'm bold enough to say I don't know on the specific question. But to reel it out a bit, I had never heard President Bush say that he had a theological conviction about Israel. The answer is I don't know about that. What I do know is that the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, Ariel Sharon, and said accurately, I believe, that Israel has never had a greater friend in the Oval Office than George W. Bush. And I believe that was true then and is true now.
Finally then, Tim, what do you want our listeners to know about the man, not the politician, but the man, President George W. Bush?
The thing I want people to know most about George W. Bush has nothing to do with foreign or security or domestic policy. The thing that I want people to know is that he is a man who is serious about his faith and conveyed to me in a way that I can barely express the most extraordinary grace possible. Because as I was working in the White House and as he was really honoring me through such a incredible experience, I was becoming a very prideful person. And as an extension of that pride, I was plagiarizing columns for my hometown newspaper. And I have to tell you, Todd, I was categorically at fault. No extenuating circumstances, no pressure, no stress, no one to blame but me. I knew what I was doing, and I was doing it from pride. I was discovered. And a reporter asked me whether this was true, and I said yes. And I write in The Man in the Middle that I knew that I would resign my White House position that day, which I did. And there's a kind of divorce that takes place in the political classes when you embarrass the president or the governor or the senator or the congressman. You're cut off, and I deserved it. That is precisely what I deserved. And I went to see the chief of staff, Josh Bolton, and I expected a woodshed moment. And instead of reading me the riot act, he asked how my wife and children were doing, and he let me know that that he forgave me, which was really remarkable. And I thought that was the last time I would ever be in the West Wing. But as I write in The Man in the Middle, it wasn't. And he told me in White House parlance that the boss wanted to see me, meaning the president. And I thought, this is going to be really bad. And I went to the Oval Office, and it was just the president and me. And I thought, this is the proverbial woodshed moment. And I walked into the Oval Office, as I say in The Man in the Middle, and I shut the door, and I turned to the president to apologize. And before I could barely get the words out, he said to me, Tim, you're forgiven. And I said, Mr. President, I tried to apologize a second time. And he said to me, I've known grace and mercy in my life, and I'm extending grace and mercy to you, Tim. You're forgiven. And I said, Mr. President, you should have taken me by the lapels and tossed me into Pennsylvania Avenue. And I had been a total hypocrite. I had embarrassed him, embarrassed my wife and children, and really brought shame upon this man who and my family, both of whom had done so much for me. And he said, we can talk about all this for the next 20 minutes, or we can talk about the last 8 years, and we did. And I went, Todd, to sit in one of the couches in the Oval Office, and he said, no, come over here and sit down. And it was the place of honor, the place where the vice president or the head of state sits. I was stunned, and we had a discussion, and we prayed together, and we embraced, and I thought, this is the last time I'll see him. And I write about this in a very intimate way in the book. And as I was turning to leave, he said, and I want you to bring your wife and sons here. We have two sons, Tim and Paul. He said, I want you to bring them here so I can tell them what a great father and son you've been. And I was truly stunned. I mean, it was surreal. And sure enough, a few days later, my wife and children, we all came to the Oval Office. There was no mention of my great sin. And in fact, my book, my memoir, is really it's called The Man in the Middle, but it could have been called Redemption. The redemption that I had by the spilled blood of Jesus Christ, I can never get over the glory and the beauty of this. And grace personified for me was George W. Bush, the leader of the free world, the man I had embarrassed. And we have seen the president many times since. We have become friends. And I'm very certain that I did not deserve that forgiveness. But because of the love of Jesus Christ and the president's very serious faith, he forgave me categorically. And I can never get to the bottom of that kind of mercy and grace, which in my life has been a signal thing.
Tim Gagelein is Vice President of External Relations for Focus on the Family, formerly served as Deputy Director of the White House Office of Public Liaison. He's authored the new book, The Man in the Middle, an inside account of faith and politics in the George W. Bush era. You can purchase The Man in the Middle at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Tim, thank you very much for your time.
Todd, I am a great fan of you and of this program, and it is truly an honor to have been on. Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss the prophet Jonah. Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri, will be our guest. Here is this man, this prophet, who is called against his will to go and preach to a city he does not want to visit. So he doesn't. He runs away. God has other plans not only for Jonah, but for the city that needs repentance. In many ways, Jonah is a great example of an Old Testament prophet. Jesus even talks about him. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about him as well. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.